We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender!
The inspirational words of Winston Churchill, reenacted by Gary Oldman in the film Darkest Hour. The year was 1940, and the British House of Commons and the British public had heard nothing quite like it before. In three speeches over the course of a month, Winston Churchill gave the British the courage to fight against Hitler's army in the early days of World War II. To quote a line from the film, he mobilised the English language and sent it to battle. Novelist and screenwriter of The Theory of Everything, New Zealander Anthony McCartan wrote The Darkest Hour book and wrote and produced the film of the same name. Anthony is with us this morning. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Where on earth are you at the moment?
Actually, you find me in Munich. The film opened last night in Germany, so I'm just doing a few sort of press commitments and things.
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
How is the film likely to go down with a German audience, given its content?
Well, Germans view Winston Churchill and, you know, the Allies as liberators who liberated them, their grandparents and the successive generations from Nazi peril, delivered them from this satanic cult. So he's a hero in Germany, it turns out, and the film has got universally very strong positive reviews here. So we're very delighted. But yeah, kind of Churchill is a world figure now. He's like a Caesar or a Lincoln or something, you know.
Yeah.
He's surpassed sort of the national boundaries.
Do you still need to approach your interviews in Germany with a degree of sensitivity, or?
No, not at all. I'm kind of familiar with German people, and my partner of many years is a Munich lass, and so I've spent a lot of time over here, and they're just the most agreeable, open-minded people. They're extraordinary. They're kind of the conscience of the world at the moment.
Yeah,
they seem to have corrected the mistakes of the past in a really exemplary way.
Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it? Now, why Churchill? What was the inspiration behind your story?
We kind of live in a very divided world right now, and very polarized world. Made so largely by all the disparities in what people have and what people feel they have a right to. So, you know, very complex time, and so. It felt appropriate to do a portrait of a great leader, and I'd always sort of been attracted to Churchill as a potential subject, but it was a little intimidating, to be honest, to write words and humorous jokes for Winston Churchill. Is it smacks a little bit of hubris.
Yeah.
But after the success of Theory of Everything, I kind of was feeling a bit plucky, and I thought I'll have a go, and if I screw it up, I'll just no one will know, so
yeah.
We'll give it a shot.
So was he a character of whom you'd studied a lot in the past? Had you read a lot of his speeches?
Well, I knew of his speeches ever since sort of university days. I'd sort of had volumes on my shelf variously titled Great Speeches That Changed the World, and I love this idea that words can really make a difference, and you know, when allied to the right idea, can in fact even change the world. And in these books, you'd always find at least one speech by Winston Spencer Churchill, and sometimes two or three. And it was at the point when I realized that he wrote three real humdingers within a 3-week period that I thought, wow, what inspired him, what motivated him to these incredible heights of grandiloquence?
Yeah.
And so that started the research. I dug in, and it was nothing less than the collapse of Central and Western Europe to the Nazi invasion and a massive domestic pressure to do a peace deal with Hitler. So all the elements were suddenly on the table for a movie. So from that, Darkest Hour eventually emerged.
Do you think the power of speech is as great today as it has always been, or do you think it has diminished somewhat?
I think they are challenging times for language that we're living in. Words really do matter, the way that they're, well, for example, politicians feel at liberty to say almost anything at the moment, knowing that tomorrow they can walk it back. This phrase, walk it back, seems to just have consumed America, which is another way of saying that I lied yesterday. And you can do that without any apparent disgrace at the moment. So, you know, we really must stand up for language, demand that words not be robbed of their meaning, and that the right people stand up with the right idea and use the right words in the right order, which is the magical formula to ensure that good overcomes evil, that empathy overcomes bigotry, that confidence and unity, you know, replaces fear and tribalism. And, you know, that really is the world we're living in, a highly tribal environment. So I think it starts with words and ends with words. We really must be vigilant. So that powerful language in the wrong hands can just as easily set free our worst impulses as it can our best. And I think that's what we're seeing is that Trump, for example, is a cunning user of language. He, like Winston Churchill, he believes in simple language, and it sort of bypasses the intellect and goes straight to the emotions. Those techniques, ancient techniques that go way back to the Greeks, you know, in the wrong hands can do terrible wrong. I mean, Churchill's rival across the English Channel, Adolf Hitler, was a fantastic speaker, incredibly inspired in terms of being able to override people's, not only their intelligence, but their morals and get them to do the most unthinkable things. So, you know, really, this is at heart a movie about language and the proposition that words matter and they can make a difference.
See, I find that really, really interesting because I expected you to say that in the modern media environment, perhaps the impact or effect of language has been reduced or has been diminished. But actually what you're saying is Trump further proves the power of language. And even though Trump might not be nearly as eloquent or perhaps as stirring as the likes of Churchill or Obama, actually he proves to the same extent, just with different motivations and perhaps different desires, the power of language.
It does indeed. I mean, Winston, when he was about 25 years old, he was consumed. He was fascinated by rhetoric and how to use it. And he drew up a few sort of guidelines, and he wrote an essay, which you can find online, called The Scaffolding of Rhetoric. And in there, he basically drew on Cicero's lessons and the Greek historians. And he focused in on simple language, repetitive use of language, and pounding on the same themes, the rule of threes. Using the same word repetitively, we will fight them on the beach, we will fight them. And suddenly you find the listener finds themselves being stirred and not really knowing why. Yeah. And this trick, if you like, is well known not only to heroes but to tyrants.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you see that simplicities like make America great again or America first. You know, America has always been first. They've always considered themselves first. Yeah. But it resonates, and you go, yeah, we've got to stand up for ourselves. So it's extraordinary how we can all be seduced by, you know, by clever people.
Yeah. Considering Churchill more broadly, so outside of just his writing and his speech making, do you think we lionize him? And is that justified?
I think we do. I mean, the old worshipful portrait of Churchill, which, you know, you see in the statues, even the way they draw his figure, chewing on a cigar, leaning into the wind, looking like someone who was born in a bad mood, you know, suggests he was simply this one-dimensional, stubborn British bulldog, always full steam ahead, incapable of doubting himself, with a battle cry always on his lips. But, you know, this image of him that you inherit it really does him an injustice, I think, by removing his complexity, and it understates, most importantly, the struggles he had with his own frailties, and foists on him superhuman qualities that finally make him less than human. And the more research that I did into him, the more I saw a self-doubting man, a man with a past littered with mistakes and miscalculations, which had, in Gallipoli had resulted in 75,000 casualties. How could such a man not doubt himself when thrown into the seat of power at the darkest moment that the British Empire had ever faced?
Yeah.
So that's where I started, and the official record reveals it gives you everything I needed. He was changing his position in his mind all the time.
Yeah.
But rather than diminish him, I think that encouraged me to think of him as a greater man, because I want my leader to think that they might be wrong.
Yeah.
Leaders who are incapable of thinking that they're wrong are terribly dangerous. So he became a much more interesting, psychologically complex character than the sort of one-note travel bureau version that we're handed.
How close was he to a peace deal with Hitler?
Very close. I thought I'd be well and truly scragged for my theory, but everybody sort of signed up to it now, as if it's not that sensational. But I was hugely excited when I delved into the records and found him basically saying that he was prepared to consider granting Germany overlordship of Europe as long as Britain's independence was assured. And then you read a sentence like that twice and three times, you go, what? That Churchill said he was ready to grant overlordship of Europe to Adolf Hitler. My God. Now, he changed his position on that, and he eventually did the right thing and decided to fight on. But there's no doubt in my mind that he seriously considered it, and he even took steps. He allowed his deputies to begin signing a memorandum to engage Italy as a broker in the peace talks, and even sort of hammered out a few sort of basic terms and surrendering Malta and Gibraltar and some African states and throwing that into the mix.
Yeah.
So they were really moving down the track. And what kind of world would we be in now if he hadn't finally stood up and written and delivered that great speech, which galvanized the nation and the world? We will fight them on the beaches, fight them on the landing grounds.
Yeah. Just in the same way, The Theory of Everything had some incredible performances. Obviously, Gary Oldman is sensational in your film. Did you write the part with him in mind?
I wrote it with a Gary Oldman type in mind. So I wanted a younger man, because Winston was... even though he was 65 when he became prime minister, he was a really vigorous, dynamic man. He sort of, all the pictures show him sort of hands behind his back, really moving fast, thinking fast. So he had all the elements of a much younger man. So what's amazing today is with prosthetics and Hollywood geniuses and stuff, they can turn, if you've got the right actor, they can pretty much make anyone look like Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
So anyway, Gary then came to this and did a year's research, and I think delivers one of the great screen performances, and everybody seems to be feeling that as well.
I also wondered, Anthony, from your position, and I'm not sure if it's something that you would have had you know, much awareness around or whatever, but I wondered if the whole Me Too campaign that is clearly sweeping through Hollywood at the moment is something that you've been surprised by or if you had any thoughts about.
Harvey was someone we were all aware of. He was someone who could, if he entered your life and made an offer to you when you were a young independent filmmaker, could literally change your life. You know, he had a huge impact on Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh's careers, you know, through opening doors and funding, you know, their early movies. But I was very wary of the guy, because stories were so ghastly about what a bully he was that I sort of avoided him. Recent years, I even had overtures to have a breakfast with him, and I found excuses not to be there. I just found him a complete creep. And so when, you know, the stories erupted, I wasn't at all surprised. It's very unfortunate, but it's, you know, from bad deeds, sometimes good things can come. And the reaction's been superb across the board.
Do you think it's likely to continue, the reaction and fallout and everything?
My hunch is that everything will fade. All movements have their moment, and that the fight is you know, it'll take a long time for changes to happen. But certainly awareness has increased and will always now be with us. So next time a creepy guy thinks of suggesting to a you know, an intern that they come up to his room, and he's thinking, maybe I should take a shower before she comes, he's going to think twice about that now, I would wager.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a damn good thing. And, you know, the mysterious thing that we're in now is that, what are the ground rules? Where are the red lines whereby, you know, a man with a sort of, in the name of chivalry, wants to do something or make a gesture or say, make a comment, or, you know, approaches someone, a woman, and puts it on you want to put the hand on their shoulder because, you know, you feel affection to them, and you draw back and you go, oh my God, what are the boundaries? So there's a sort of intergenerational shift on what's appropriate, and you know, I think the ground rules have yet to be established.
Although you would hope that they would be fairly obvious, wouldn't they?
Yeah, you would, but they have shifted, you know. So what was acceptable, you know, I'm not talking about the dark acts, but just in terms of normal discourse and the way you made a joke or stuff, it's clearly shifted from the 70s and 80s to now.
Yeah.
So stuff that passed muster then is completely, completely unsavory now. So, you know, that's changing. I think that's changing again right now. And there's another shift and another sort of redefinition of that. And even, you know, it's interesting. I was just reading some of the papers, and the French women are coming out, and they think that the interesting fun and play between man and woman is in danger by this movement, that it's an overcorrection, and they're being lambasted for their comments. So it's a really interesting debate, and it's a conversation we all need to have.
Thank you so much for your time, Anthony. I know you're very busy, and all the very best when the Oscar nominations are finalised this week. We will be thinking of you, and I'm sure you'll be making your way to Los Angeles in a month or so's time. But a real pleasure to speak, and congratulations on the success of your film.
And it's great to speak with you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
That is Anthony McCartan. Of course, you can go and see Darkest Hour, How Churchill Brought England Back from the Brink, starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. Gary Oldman won the Golden Globe as Best Actor for his performance. It really is an incredible performance, so go and see it if you have the opportunity.